The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Helping make it all possible is the generous partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I'll trust you enjoy.
I have a remarkable man on the video and audio right now. His day job, so to speak, has been associate professor of medicine at Brown University. He's an epidemiologist of all things. I admit, not a group that I have instant respect for, but I do for him. But he is known to people around the world for, he's one of the greatest living scholars of Islam, and specifically of Islam and the Jews. I don't know how he has been able to do the work he has done. If he were a full-time academic, it would be an achievement. But he's a full-time epidemiologist. And now a book of surpassing scholarship and understanding, The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism by Andrew Bostom, B-O-S-T-O-M, Boston with an M, M-D. There's a foreword by Ibn Warraq. Ibn Warraq, I've read much of his work, is a Muslim, or was a Muslim, and now writes under a pseudonym because he doesn't want to get killed. Andrew Bostom, it's a true honor. You're an exceptional man, scholar, gutsy guy. So this is huge, this topic, and people listening will be lucky to have heard you. Let's begin at the beginning. What was Muhammad's attitude towards Jews?
So Muhammad's initial attitude was that they would recognize him as their prophet, and that they would take kindly to him, follow him, etc. He found, and again, Janice, we have to take this on faith. It's all the Muslim narrative. We don't really have independent historical confirmation for any of this. But what Muslims learn, what Muslims teach, is that Muhammad was very disappointed in the Jews' reaction to him, and they resorted to all kinds of chicanery and then serious stuff, attempting to assassinate him, et cetera, and sabotage him. And he felt compelled to conquer and subdue them and bring them under nascent Islamic law. So it's a very, very contentious relationship. And then we see a lot of melding together of in terms of the anti-Semitism, of themes that are interwoven with the Quran itself, with the traditions of Muhammad. And so in one iconic scene, if you can envision it that way, Muhammad is besieging the Jewish tribe Banu Qurayza. And he's allegedly saying outside, their fortress, he's deriding them as brothers of apes and pigs. And this is a Quranic epithet. It's in the fifth surah chapter of the Quran, the 60th verse. Ultimately, of course, the siege is successful. They surrender. And because they're accused of treachery, Muhammad himself beheads somewhere between 600 and 900 of the post-pubescent males, and then the rest are enslaved, and this becomes the prototype for how any resistance to his authority is dealt with in terms of the Jews. Eventually, it winds up where there's a farming oasis. Where there's no hostility towards Muhammad, these are Jewish farmers, And they are attacked in what is believed to be, again, according to the Muslim narrative, one of the first truly aggressive jihad campaigns. And it's violent, they're subdued, and they become the first dhimmi, Dennis. Those that are willing to surrender are allowed to function as vassals under Islamic law and contribute a poll tax or some sort of remuneration from their farming, but they give up all their autonomy. They're de-weaponized, and again, this becomes incorporated into Islamic law. So the best that Jews can hope for under Islamic law is a
status.
Form of vassalage. Vassalage. Yeah.
Dhimmi, folks, is D-H-I-M-M-I. Christians are also dhimmi. Those are the only groups allowed to even be dhimmi. The others were generally offered the sword or conversion. Tell me if this is accurate, that Muhammad fasted on Yom Kippur until the Jews rejected him. Are you familiar with that?
I'm honestly not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's something. That's why I wanted to bounce it off you. I've read it in so many places, but I wanted to ask someone who's really gone through all of this. All right, it's not here or there, but he did make overtures to the Jewish community. They rejected him. He beheaded 800 or whatever it was, and that was the beginning. When the terrorist groups quote, "There is a Jew behind the tree." What is that from?
So this is also Muhammad. Muhammad in a tradition, in a hadith, talks about that the Jews will have to be annihilated to usher in the Messianic age, and this is what you find not only in the Hamas covenant, but it's a tradition that's repeated. And this is the problem, Dennis. It's a tradition that's repeated by major Islamic teaching institutions like Al-Azhar University. It's commonplace throughout the Middle East. It's commonplace historically. We can see it referred to in classical Quranic commentaries. But it's basically central to Muslim eschatology, end of times theology. Both Sunni and
what, Shia. What is central to end of times eschatology?
That the Jews have to be annihilated.
Really?
To usher in,
and that's in the Hadith.
Yes.
That's post Quran teachings. I just want to be
exactly. Exactly. And as a matter of fact, Dennis, this was a remarkable poll, because I'd like to talk, if we could, a little bit about polling data that we have, contemporary polling data. But in 2011, Stanley Greenberg, who you may remember was a very respected Democratic pollster, I think he still is. He did something remarkable. He went to Judea Samaria, to the West Bank and Gaza, and polled over 1,000 Palestinians in Arabic, and he pulled out two elements of the Hamas covenant. One that basically it's Article 7, I believe, that quotes that hadith that you just mentioned, and wanted to see how many of the Palestinians abided it, and 73% felt that was the way things should be,
that the Jews should be annihilated.
Yes, but so this is a genocidal theme. When it came to another article in Hamas covenant, which he quoted. It's in Article 15. That is a section about jihad to be waged by the entire Muslim community, the global ummah, as they refer to it, to destroy Israel as a political entity, not necessarily to destroy to wipe out individual Jews, although it's hard to separate the two to a certain extent. And that was accepted, abided by 80% of Palestinians. But what he did that was remarkable was that he specifically used the language from these articles in the survey. Other questions were asked as well. But that was the first time I ever saw any pollster even attempt such a thing. And you know, Dennis, it's actually, when you look more broadly at attitudes, Some of the best polling data comes from an organization that I think neither of us, it's fair to say, have a lot of respect for, and that's the Anti-Defamation League. However, for over 20 years, they have developed a very simple and elegant survey instrument, which it's gone through two iterations. But basically, they list 11 anti-Semitic stereotypes. And the individual respondent just has to sort of check off and say which ones they agree with. If they agree with the majority, so 6 out of 11, they're defined, and I'm using epidemiologic terms, but they're defined as an index case of extreme anti-Semitism. Then ADL applies this across countries, populations, and simply tallies up how common is this? When they went to the Middle East and North Africa, and they did this as part of a 100-country survey, they found that the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world were all in this region. And the commonality, the prevalence of this degree of anti-Semitism, again, it's extreme anti-Semitism, was anywhere from 74% to 93%. And of course, also unsurprisingly, the prize winner in terms of the dubious prize winner, where the 93% was the Muslims of Gaza and the West Bank. Although close behind them at 92% were the Iraqis. And what's happened, unfortunately, is that as the Muslim populations have migrated into Western Europe and the United States, not to this degree of virulence, but increasingly approaching it, you see the same sort of disparity. When you look at the global data, again, it's the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world. When you look at Western Europe and you start to apply this same survey there, you're now seeing the latest iteration. They took a hiatus for COVID, but in 2000, at the end of 2022, they at least surveyed the Muslims of France and Belgium. And in France, this degree of anti-Semitism amongst the Muslims was 62%. It was only it was 15% amongst the Christians. Similar results in the low to mid 50s.
Yeah, you could say only if it's 15%.
It's a lot.
Well, I'm agreeing only is valid. 15% means nothing to me. About 30 years ago, I established the Elvis Presley principle. When I read that 12% of Americans thought Elvis Presley was alive, I said, that means never take 12% seriously. You can get 12% to say anything. So if it's
disproportionate, though, is the point.
And yes, sort of your point is extremely well taken. Of the 16 most anti-Semitic countries, were they all Muslim?
Oh, yeah. Every country was in the North Africa and the Middle East.
So again, the ADL, which I believe and you believe as absolutely downplayed Islamic anti-Semitism. Nevertheless, it has acknowledged that in its survey of countries, the 16 most anti-Semitic countries were all Muslim and they were in the Middle East. Am I repeating you correctly?
Yes. It's remarkable what they do between the raw data and the press releases. There's this yawning gap, Dennis, and it's very misleading. And I think it's why people are shocked when I tell them that that's what the surveys have actually shown. And they've shown this repeatedly. You know, a colleague of ours, Mort Klein, I briefed him on these data, and he was at a congressional hearing on anti-Semitism in 2019, and he actually made slides and posters of these data, and so he's going through it just the way I went through it, with you, and you know the way these hearings run, there's a lot of gaps between the different witnesses, and it just so happened that ADL was there, and so about a half hour after Mort presented these data. Again, where the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world are all in the Muslim Middle East and North Africa, her response, I recorded it, was unbelievable. In other words, these societies are virtually 100% Muslim, with the exception of Lebanon, which is about 60% Muslim now. It's Muslim majority. So her response to this disproportionate anti-Semitism
from their own data.
Yes. Eileen Hershenov, senior VP for policy, was, quote, one of the witnesses, you know, Mort Klein, talked about global attitudes that we look at. And the ADL does track that. Her vulnerable, marginalized communities have bigotry within them. And I my jaw dropped when she said that. So in other words, the 99% Muslims are a marginalized community in Yemen, you know, in Saudi Arabia. But that was the explanation.
Do we have a recording of her saying that?
Yes, I can send it to you. It's incredible.
If you send it to me, I will play it on my show.
It's incredible.
When did this happen?
This was 2019, the spring of 2019.
I have gone on record saying that the Anti-Defamation League has done less to combat anti-Semitism than to foster it. It's a radical statement. I say it with sadness. It is a useless organization, in my opinion, except for a handful of raw data things like this one. And it's very sad. They're the wokest of the woke. And now they've been hit on the head.
It's a serial offense when it comes to this, because the last survey that they published was from Europe in data collected through 2022, but put out in May. And again, this striking result from France and Belgium, they literally didn't mention it. That it's almost as if it's gotten more brazen. The denial, the negation is more brazen. They literally didn't mention that 62% of the Muslims of France now exhibit extreme anti-Semitism, or 55% of the Muslims in Belgium. They literally didn't mention it. It's in the data, but they didn't mention it at all in their press release. And they're screaming about white supremacism.
Right, and transphobia.
Well, a million phobias.
Yes, million phobias.
But I think when you want to do something to combat this problem, and I think unfortunately a lot of it is it's institutionalized. The institutions of Islam are still teaching these very, very negative stereotypes of Jews, like Al Azhar University. But when you have an organization that won't even be honest with what the data are showing, It's completely disorienting.
Their own data.
Yeah.
This is extremely sobering stuff that you're revealing, Andrew, to people. So the 16 most anti-Semitic countries, I want to repeat, in the world today are all Muslim, and they're in the Middle East. So let me ask you this. Are there any non-anti-Semitic Muslim countries?
I would say as you get outside the Middle East, you certainly see the prevalence of this extreme high prevalence, you know, 74% to 93%. You see it drop down into the 50s.
Like Indonesia.
Although it's still around 50% when you get out of the and the problem, Dennis, is that it's always disproportionate. That's the clear signal that you get from the ADL data. So even in this country, you know, the one time ADL applied this instrument in the recent past in this country was 2017, and already by then I can't imagine it's gotten any better, probably worse. Already by then, the background rate amongst non-Muslims for the commonality of this degree of anti-Semitism was 14% in the United States. Amongst Muslims, it was already 34%. So it's across the world, it's always 2 to 4-fold higher amongst Muslims. But yes, this is a much more philo-Semitic country. We assume a lot of Muslims have come here to get away from these kinds of societies. So it's less, but it's always disproportionate.
So it is widely stated that Jews had it really good under Muslim rule in the past. Would you comment on that?
It's a canard. I mean, you know, and it's again, Dennis, it was largely manufactured by Jews. One of the European Jewish historians, greats, tried to write these hagiographies about Muslim Spain. They're completely ahistorical, but he had a noble purpose in mind, which was that he was going to create this idyllic state to show to the Germans that look, there was a society, again, idyllic, that treated us so much better. You should be ashamed. You can do better here in Germany. Now, okay, we can say that maybe there was some sort of a noble purpose in that. But when you actually look at the history of how the Jews fared in Muslim Spain, remember the largest pogrom on the European continent, the same year as the Battle of Hastings, was the complete annihilation of the Jews of Granada in 1066. And we have a great historian, a Jewish historian, Moshe Perlman, completely unapologetic. Perlman's specialty was studying the Muslim, Christian, Jewish polemic of the Middle Ages. And he went back and showed how the incitement of that pogrom actually related to the commonality, as he put it, of the use of this theme in the Quran of the Jews as apes or apes and pigs. And the fact that a small cadre of them had risen outside the limits of the Dhimma. And this was used to incite the masses to wipe the Jews out. Again. And remember, Maimonides escaped in a later period from Spain during the terrible Almohad persecutions. And he wrote in his epistle to the Jews of Yemen, now this might have been an exaggeration on the basis of his own experience, that there was no persecution that matched the Muslim persecution. They actually initiated an inquisition in North Africa under the Almohads, where Jews that had been forcibly converted to Islam were monitored and suspected, and some did, of practicing Judaism surreptitiously. Some historians believe that became a prototype for what's much more famous, which was the Spanish Inquisition. But ultimately, Muhammad had to flee North Africa disguised as a Jew. And yes, there was in Egypt under the Fatimids, he was able to resume.
Disguised as a Muslim.
Disguised as a Muslim. I'm sorry. Disguised as a Muslim. He was able to resume, being a sort of court Jew dhimmi, but there wasn't that aggressive persecution going on in Fatimid Egypt. However, he's getting a letter from the Jews in Yemen around this same period of time that they're undergoing a wave of pogroms and persecutions in far flung Yemen. So, it's a very idealized situation to say, basically the Jews and other non-Muslims lived under the Sharia, which is innately oppressive to non-Muslims.
What I think was prevalent then and continues to be was anger at Christianity. So we have to show that the Muslims really treated us better.
Particularly in the period I was mentioning in the 19th century.
Yeah, with Heinrich Retz, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But, Maimonides also made something, a very interesting point, and he was not a fan of Christianity by any stretch of the imagination. In that same epistle to the Jews of Yemen, he talks about very angrily how he'd like to find where Jesus was buried and rattle the bones around or something like that. But in his commentaries on the Torah, he talks about how Jews should attempt to teach Torah to Christians because they will see some rootedness, some commonality. But he says for safety reasons alone, never attempt to do that with Muslims. They will find it so blasphemous that the Jews' life would be at risk.
That's a fascinating distinction. Where did he write that?
In a Torah commentary.
Yeah. You make a list of things you need to send me. The Christians of Lebanon have not done well. The Christians in West Africa are being massacred in the tens of thousands by Muslims, virtually unreported in the West. Only Israel attacking Muslims, and only as a response, of course, to the butchery of October 7th. That's reported. Do you think, is there an analogous animosity toward Christians in Islam?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So what's interesting is that sometimes doctrinally, the attitude of Islam towards Christians appears to be somewhat milder. However, that hasn't played out historically. If anything, I would say the persecution and certainly the mass killings of Christians under Islam has been worse than for Jews, simply by virtue of population density, if nothing else. So in our era, Dennis, you can actually, I've done this. I've made a rubric where you look at, like ADL data, extreme anti-Semitism. Then you look at Christian persecution data from something like Open Doors, which monitors Christian persecution across the world. And then you look at Pew data, which looks at desire for strict application of the Sharia. And where you see the desire for strict application of the Sharia at its height, you see the greatest degrees of anti-Semitism and Christian persecution. So I think they're all interrelated. And as Open Doors finds every year, with the exception of North Korea and China, all the leading persecutors of Christians are Muslim societies.
So what has the reaction to you been? Are you called an Islamophobe regularly?
Oh, of course. It's a reflexive response, which is also there's some irony to that too, because Islamophobia, apart from this modern nonsensical construct, is actually a doctrine. I mean, the way the jurists make very clear, and Muhammad himself in a hadith says, "I have been made victorious through terror." But the idea of that is not just as gruesome as it sounds. It is gruesome at a certain level. The idea, as the jurists would later formulate it, was to terrorize these populations or segments of these populations so that the rest of the population would submit and it would spare, first and foremost, Muslim casualties, but also actually the casualties amongst those conquered peoples.
All right.
And it would just enhance Islamization.
Andrew Bostom is a legend among those who know the subject. The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, Dr. Andrew Bostom. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dennis. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell a friend to go to Town Hall Review and sign up as well today.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.